Welcome to Strip, the podcast of a novel by Andrew Banks. Chapter 1. A dancer's fingertips, etched with a language that is no longer decipherable, tickle space, trace its volume, press, pull, contract, constrict, until they touch, grasp, hold and balance, shift what is on and off balance. They retreat, release, flick, dab. The careless times they graze nipples, trace filaments across the skin. They touch the sternum and search for the heart. A slam door echoes up this stairwell from the floor below. Am I naked underneath this bedsheet? Is there bleeding, blood? Reassuring. It means I still have a heart. They say it's in our blood, this new disease. So far, they say, hundreds have died because of it. And my balls ache. My lip throbs. I taste the warm blood in my saliva mixed with something salty. There must be tears. I can barely see. There must be tears. If I had something in my stomach, I would vomit. I remember Kent said our New Year's resolution was to make 1983 our year. Here's to you and me in 83, he said. Hell of a year it's turning out to be. Everyone has a Daniel, and with luck, you'll have him early on to break your heart to pieces and then to get over it. Never make the same stupid goddamn mistake again. Funny how you can talk yourself into thinking the road less traveled will be a noble trip. I tripped on the road less traveled. I haven't thought much about him recently, not his sharp chin or his Adam's apple with the tiny cleft of stray whiskers that his razor couldn't reach, or his long nose extending down from his forehead, making him look like the distant relative of the black and white television test pattern Indian. He was superb and perfect, and he knew it. Someday someone might be inspired to stage a full-length ballet about nothing more than his eyebrows. In this stairwell, in this light, Danielle is no more than a flicker. Through him, I have come to understand lust, désir. Through Kent, love, amour. Lust singes the hairs on your hand and can just as easily bite them with frost. Lust can kill quickly. Love tears your world asunder, then leaves you to die on the battlefield. But if I have to blame anyone, that is, other than myself, I would start with Danielle. I could blame Kharkov, too, who brought in Danielle as a guest repetiteur at the end of our tour. Montreal, our last stop on the home stretch of our first national tour as a big league company. And 1982 was the company's year. We premiered the full-length Prokofiev Romeo and Juliet. We were exhausted and bloated from too much road food. The ballerinas were thick around their middles. Even the anorexics were struggling. From endless health muffins and Caesar salads with house dressing hold the croutons in the name of the diet, and late night post-performance carrot cake, or the great fatigue fighter, chocolate, in its many evil forms. Cigarettes were no longer keeping the addicts thin. We ignored our colds and our injuries. Women taped their toes, wrapped their ankles, and rinsed the blood from their shoes. Men danced through pulled groins, shin splints, and torn Achilles tendons. We were sick from drafty buses, drafty hotel rooms, drafty rehearsal halls, and each other. A few sought refuge in chamomile tea, steamy showers, and naps. In the midst of it all, I, too, needed a pick-me-up. This malaise, this touring burnout didn't stop me or anyone else from trying to impress the arrogant fuck Danielle Tremaine, Montreal's ballet wunderkind, the teacher and choreographer you went to if you wanted to win a medal at a ballet competition. Deep in Place des Arts, in the bright rehearsal hall, cavernous ceilings, mirrors for miles, Kharkov announced, Monsieur Danielle Tremaine will be giving us company class while we are here in Montreal. Giving us, Kharkov only took class in December when he faked his way through Drosselmeyer and the Nutcracker. Even then, he usually just fumbled his way through bar. Kharkov was nervous about impressing Montreal. Danielle would be his salvation. I looked around the studio. Some dropped their heads, pretending to limber their necks. Others caught my eye. Some rewrapped their warm-up gear, leg warmers and sweaters, placing them strategically to hide the extra pounds. Danielle Tremaine, the legend. People had compared him to Nijinsky, said he was built more like a bird than a human, but it didn't stop his very ethereal body from betraying him. As he rehearsed an understudy for Montreal Conservatoire's production of Swan Lake in Glasgow, he tore his Achilles badly. Therapy went well, but he fell on some stairs when he was wearing the cast and ripped the healing, the muscles and the skin, even worse than the original injury. His dancing career went kaput, but it hasn't stopped anybody from wanting a piece of his greatness. I tried to take it in stride as Danielle stooped, all 6'3" of him, the top of his head, his thinning crown next to my crotch, correcting my line and adjusting my instep. Oh sure, I have been nervous to the core with each new coach, teacher, and choreographer, but when he touched me that first time, it hit me like the February wind at the corner of Portage and Maine. My breath was shallow, my heart frappéd inside my rib cage. My ears rang and my vision went dim. I squeezed the bar, inhaled, and fought a sudden numbness in my thighs. Like I said, it is the kind of attraction that will eventually destroy you. He ignored me the rest of the class, thank God, but I couldn't stop looking at those big hands that had touched me, the broad feet that had walked in my direction, the same feet that had danced all the great roles at so young an age on international stages, and at the way he flicked his famous wrists as he dreamily explained something into the air. I suppose that blasé, unimpressed look was how he got dancers to push themselves. The dancer's ego is a frail and determined thing. After class, in the bright hallway, while the others wandered ahead, I sensed him behind me, and though I wanted to flee, something inside shouted, "Stop, for God's sakes, linger!" And I listened. Danielle Tremaine stopped me with a touch to my elbow. "You have a nice line," he told me. Then he dropped his voice. "But the company is destroying your technique and your body." Then he put his hand on my shoulder, looked into my eyes and smiled, daring me to be shocked. "You have a nice ass," he said. It seems my heart, as a muscle, pounding out beats and measures, is hardwired to that muscle between my legs. I had never felt so obvious, but I had never met a Danielle Tremaine. "Thank you. Would you like some private coaching?" But I couldn't speak. I mean here, after class. Was I the only one who noticed the upper right corner of his mouth twist when he spoke English, and how it was met by a twitching at the corner of his right eye, as if it was painful to speak? The rest of the day I wandered the tight neighborhoods of the plateau. Narrow streets of walk-ups pressed in on top of each other, iron stairways extending to the street, all punctuated by small cafes. But any place I came across seemed empty unless I could imagine myself there with him. My mind dipped in and out of what a professional coaching session with this man would involve. Danielle Tremaine having his way a million different ways with me. Why me? Second soloist, and only then to fill the ranks. After class the next morning, I lingered while he talked to his fawning fans, mostly company members who would have killed for a coaching session, and a few notables such as the mayor and dance critics who were observing class. Danielle was a national treasure for Montreal. I continued to stretch until the room thinned out. "Why don't we start with some jumps? I can see you are a jumper." This was true, although being a good jumper means you have to work on the weaknesses, and it forced me to perfect my turns. So I started with simple changement, to get some real height and momentum and to hopefully impress. He stood close and calmly placed his hands on my shoulders, pressing against my lift. A logical action. But then he told me to stop. Do you know what you're doing?
Changement.
Your fifth position is forced. I've always done it that way. How are your knees? Tender, but... One of Martha Graham's principal dancers told us we would never have a day without pain until we stopped dancing. I had lumped all of my aches and pains under this noble disclaimer. You're forcing your fifth. The company likes it that way.
Why?
I paused.
See, you have no idea. Do you think people in the audience are going to notice?
No, of course not. It hurts me to watch. I mean, your jump is good enough to distract you or anyone else from your bad technique. Your knees must stay over your metatarsals. Does that not make sense?
I just stared at him.
Of course he was right, but it's like smoking. You know, it's bad for you, but...
Are you listening to me? Stop staring. Your knees are made to bend forward, not sideways. Turnout originates from the hip. Why are you forcing your fifth? Jump in first and do not force it.
As I jumped, he walked around me, placing his hand on my lower back, on my stomach, on my upper chest.
How does that feel?
I could have really told him, but all I said was, off balance.
Of course, the rest of you will have to get used to doing it properly, not overcompensating. Soon it will be easy. Soon you'll understand the saute.
We worked on several sequences from corner to corner, a bit of Bluebird from Sleeping Beauty. But to do it properly would be another story. Daniel walked beside me as I moved, occasionally taking my hands and throwing them skyward.
Think of your landings. Think of the in-between.
But soon my legs turned to rubber. Why the hell were we doing a variation no one would ever give me a shot at?
I want you to think of all of this tonight when you sleep. I want to see your body rearranging itself, changing the foundation, shifting to its core. But don't be mistaken, this won't happen overnight.
I left Place des Arts and vowed to keep my mouth shut as far as Daniel Tremaine was concerned. I had a hot bath, a nap, strong tea, and an early dinner, and went for company warm-up. All I could think about was his firm touch. I worried that my dancing would be sloppy, but I was light. I was nimble. I was fueled by something unexpected. The next day in class, I became aware of others. They must have known about the coaching. I stayed at the back. After, I lingered again, and when the groupies had dissipated, Daniel approached me. He rolled his eyes at the departing stragglers.
Did you think about what I told you?
I nodded, but my voice caught in my throat.
Good. Let's learn a bit of Le Spectre de la Rose,
something the company was planning as part of the next season. Again, a long shot for me, or was it? He walked me through the first bit, showing me the choreography, miming everything on a small scale as if having a conversation with himself, complete with arm movements. Soon, I was flying across the studio. We worked mostly on the entrance and the Grand Jeté and the Grand Jeté en Tournant, but he seemed more concerned with my arms when he took hold of my waist on each jump, lifting me beyond what I was capable of. As I focused on the ceiling, I'm sure he was focused right bang on my crotch. This required the utmost concentration. Finally, I came to rest on terra firma. I searched his expression to decipher what he thought of my jumps, but I was preoccupied with the why of this. Why was he coaching me? Had Kharkov requested it? Was I due for another promotion? Or was it rather what I suspected? Did he have, as my friend Rochelle liked to say, his compass pointing in my direction? I couldn't tell.
Your legs are now throwing your arms off. You have to take risks now, and the arms have to go higher. Everything has to go up. Do you understand? You might as well be doing this with a walker, and for God's sake, do something with your eyes. They're absolutely blank. Look a little like you are enjoying it. But I was terrified. And I wanted so much to enjoy it. To be coached by one of Canada's great teachers. To imagine that one day Bluebird and Le Spectre de la Rose could be mine was too much. My back? Your everything. I didn't have the strength for what he wanted. It will take a while to get your landings back. That's all. You've lost your center of gravity. Now go and change. I'll wait. I couldn't imagine what he would wait for. My blank stare, my vapid smile, my rotten jumps. These 2 days had presented the opportunity of a lifetime. He could have been working with the principals. I washed layers of sweat, savored the coolness of the water. I had a few hours to recover before our warm-up and performance, and I was keeping Danielle Tremaine waiting. I stepped out of the shower, a little less defeated, taking a solitary moment to survey my naked form in the mirror, something less likely to be criticized. There in the mirror's reflection stood Danielle Tremaine. From his mouth tumbled the words, "Would you like to go for a coffee?" Dancer's language for everything from a mini debrief to mini therapy to gossip to foreplay. Tomorrow? Wasn't there a chorus line of principals queuing up for him? All I had to offer was me, second soloist. Every guy, even the straight ones, and all the women in the studio followed my eyeline the next morning. It was impossible and against the laws of the universe. Danielle and John, they must have laughed, but I was grinning behind that blank stare. Romeo and Juliet were nothing compared to this. But whatever else he may have been, Danielle Tremaine was a perfectionist and did give two shits about my technique. I still believe that. No man has ever been as direct. When we went for that coffee on Rue Saint-Denis, there are some perks to being a professional dancer. You have time off at odd hours of the day. You feel physical 100% of the time. You can sit in a Montreal cafe with a famous Danielle Tremaine while the world buzzes around you, and you can dream. He told me more in his killer kind of way. If you want any kind of life as a dancer, you must pay attention. You started late. I swam competitively until about 5 years ago. So you're 20. No, I'm going on 22. Swimming was boring. The dancer's friend. That's true. It made me supple and strong, but I needed more than endless hours of lengths at 5:30 a.m. five mornings a week and at Edmonton winters. But when I started dancing, it's no use starting late only to finish early. They've given you a job after 5 years of this. A bit longer, I danced and swam. Why second soloist? I was next in line. You should be further along. You get paid a little more than course, so what? If you stay on this path, you'll be in a wheelchair by the time you are 30, teaching little girls to point their toes for the rest of your life. You obviously have a gift. Don't abuse it. These were the first positive words I'd heard him say. And don't be arrogant. They always need males, especially in the company. The prairies are a wasteland. Males don't last there. They're born there. The prairies are too limiting, too Russian. Maybe Vaganova will make you strong, but your muscles will bulge and your joints will turn to putty. I bit my lip while he sneered. You'll be bulky with ties like the Winnipeg football team. What do you call them? The Blue Bombers. The Blue Bombers. There'll be no difference in their white tights and dance belts. Jock straps. The right corner of his mouth reached the far corner of his eye as he stifled a laugh. You must know tout est au rab. He flicked at a bag of sugar. But your knees, mon ami, won't last. You're telling me to give up on second soloist? The company repertoire is tired and boring. Romeo and Juliet is their newest ballet in, what, 30 years? The company's expanding. Not if they want to tour. He was right. Romeo and Juliet had been a gamble that paid off. And as far as my knees were concerned, he was right. They burned every time I stepped up onto the street curb, although they were fine in the studio. The hours I had spent dancing now rivaled all of my schooling ever. As a child, I badly wanted to get up on that stage with Nuria Evan Fontaine, even if I was going to be stuck beside the scenery or in the shadows, holding Rudy's cloak. No matter if it was the Nutcracker, Rodeo, or Swan Lake that my mother took me to, sitting in the audience while the action was on stage was pointless. 7 years ago, I stopped twirling around the basement, slipping on the carpet, wearing holes in my socks. I stopped dreaming. In fact, it was a Thursday in early December that I took the leap and lied about a trip to a doctor for a flu shot. Yes, I climbed that same narrow staircase that led to our family doctor, but kept right on going. Up, up to the place that made the high ceiling in the doctor's office throb and sent fine plaster dust snowing down during checkups. 6 months earlier, on the staircase where I had previously seen only armies of young girls with tight buns on their heads, I saw two male dancers ascend. If there were other men dancing in Edmonton, I would too. But it took 6 more months of dreaming, yearning, gathering my gumption. Soon I lied about other things. Swim practice, movies, getting together with friends, all traded for a dream. Look at me now, lying about everything, to everyone, myself included. Sitting in this stairwell now has nothing to do with the dream. Up I went, like Alice following the rabbit down the hole, but in the other direction, to a wonderland of Chopin, played on out-of-tune pianos, the thick scent of old lady perfume, sweat, talcum powder, bodies wafted corner to corner across creaky floors, mirrors for walls, boxes of resin in room corners, people dashing from dressing rooms to studios, draped on the bar, sitting splayed in hallways, stretching, waiting for their class to begin. In the musty windowed office, Lisa, my first teacher, looked over the class list. Are you a football player? I swim. We get football players, their coach sends them. A few times and then they're gone. Can't be the tights, can it? She smiled at me. I relaxed. God, football. Football is some kind of an abomination to the human movement. Frightens me to see these guys with clunky feet and mitts for hands banging their knees sideways. Funny. In the long run, ballet is probably going to do as much damage. She winked at me. I want to dance. Show up regularly and I won't charge you. After the class, she stopped me at the door. We will see you again, she smiled. My father could have adjusted her slightly protruding eye teeth. I could tell by her openness that she liked men a lot. She said a lot of guys who started late had careers. I couldn't believe we were talking about free classes, talking about careers like it was a possibility and not just a dream. My whole world was starting to shift. I was involved in something I absolutely loved. Keep swimming, Lisa said, for now. So there I was, plié, tendu with the beginner adults, women, and the two men I had seen on the stairs. Then Lisa threw me into a room of little girls balancing on tippy toes, learning the syllabus for a moment, and after that into seasoned recreational adults with timid wrists and tight fingers, until she figured I could rub shoulders with those who had hoped to be dancers one day, and along with them, classes of serious teens with talent, strength, discipline, and their dreams still in front of them. This all meant that some nights I was at the studio for up to 4 hours. The girls needed a male partner for their exams, and the adults wanted partners to make class more challenging, and all I wanted to do was dance. A simple port-au-bras at the bar was enough to satisfy the craving. I couldn't wait to get to the studio, change, stretch the soreness out of my muscles and see how much further I could turn and how much more controlled I could be when I leapt. At night, I dreamt I was so much better. When I swam, I reached for the end of the pool. Now when I danced, I reached for the heavens. Just turn, Lisa shouted, while I made myself dizzy with a tour en l'air. Worry about your technique later. Just get around for God's sake. Be careless. Classmates started to recognize me as a dancer. And if I recognized them on the street, they'd introduce me as one of the dancers from the studio. It seemed unfair that because of my sex, I was fast-tracked. Being called a dancer can be like a drug. Yet I didn't feel deserving of the title, not then. Soon Lisa asked me to come and dance with a group of retired pros in the morning in the company class. "Stay in the back," she told me, "and follow. You'll get it." I skipped school to make that class, and soon we were rehearsing for festivals as far away as Red Deer. Fantasy ballets, Ukrainian folk dancing, holding the girls by the waist on cue, then grabbing my arm, run here, run there, jump, kick, wait for the applause, bow. I begged off my parents' European tour. It was Mom who wanted me along, not Dad, with the excuse of a part-time job. But while they toured Europe, I toured the sunbaked stages at Alberta County Fairs. Old ladies and the old queer stage door Johnny off the farm were my fans. I looked like an honest-to-God dancer. My body took to it. My brain, my balance, my thighs thickened, counterbalancing my aching butt. "You've got to stretch all the time," Lisa said, "especially in this heat. Take advantage of the heat. You need strength up the back of your legs, too." My swimmer's shoulders screamed with each new partner I lifted. My lower back ached, and I couldn't keep my eyes off myself. I am still obsessed with the potential for beauty, proportion, and line. Lisa had said I wasn't too old, and when Madame Defilé, Lisa's wrinkled, stooping boss and mentor, and a Canadian dance icon whose old woman perfume scent infused the place, learned I was serious, she challenged me, as if to prove Lisa wrong. "You're the swimmer," she said in faded Queen's English. "Maybe we could make a dancer out of you, but I doubt it." She would grab my leg at the top of the grand battement and push it higher, shoving her sharp nails into the back of my knee. "Don't cheat," she shouted her commands. With her back to me, she would put my thigh from its joint while leaning against me to keep my hip back in a tug of war with my torso. Then she'd shake my arms. "You've got to press the weight of the world down. They aren't just there to hang off the side of your trunk. Now press!" To get what she wanted, she slapped me and screamed until her pale, powdered face turned pink. From time to time, she would throw me out of the class and then ask me what the hell I was doing sitting in the waiting area. And, "Get the bloody hell back in here, you bloody son of a bitch. If you want to dance, then bloody dance, for the love of God, show some spine." I suppose I was a whipping post for all the princes who had never courted her. Once and only once did she waver. We were facing the bar in arabesque, and I tightened the hell out of my lower back while squeezing my butt to get my leg up. The muscles fighting each other to maintain the form while stretching my leg through to the end of my foot. "Now, John, that's good," she said. Did I hear that correctly? The pianist stopped playing. The other students fell silent. "You others would do well to follow this young man's example. He's working bloody hard to make up for lost time, and though he may not make it, I have a feeling he'll die trying." Her compliments were calculated and short-lived. "Swimming isn't enough. Do weights," she shouted. "Cans of soup if you must, lots of repetitions until it burns, and push-ups. Drop and do 40. Now, you wait until you have a men's class, then tell me you want to dance. Swim, aha. Have you thought of joining the army? It would be a hell of a lot easier." In spite of her reputation, she had garnered a Governor General's award, bringing ballet to the prairies. She was slowly forgetting and being forgotten. It was obvious she would never get the perfection she demanded from anyone. In the end, I heard she died alone. "Maybe I can blame this all on Lisa," she said. "I could do it."